Page Fright is recorded on the traditional unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. Hello and welcome back to Page Fright. My name is Andrew French. I'm on Twitter, if you're still there, at the Andrew French. And this, of course, is the world's first podcast, the only podcast that I host. And folks, today we have a fantastic episode for you. It's one that I am yet again excited about. But I do want to mention, really quickly, before we get into the episode, a little bit of housekeeping for you. This is going to be the last episode for a little bit. Now, I think people hear last episode and they're like, oh my god, it's over, we're done. I'm thinking of this less that way and more as like, I need June off. You'll probably notice if you're listening to this on the day that it comes out, which, you know, thank you if you are, that's fantastic, I love the enthusiasm, that it's May 31st, and this is the May episode. So you're probably sitting there like, Andrew, you really left this one late. The thing is, I didn't. I did this interview a while ago, like a couple weeks ago with Jen Curran, who's today's guest, and I'll speak to them shortly and give you an intro to them shortly and their fantastic book, Trinity Street. But we actually spoke a while back, a few weeks ago, kind of near the start of May, and I've just been sitting on this interview because things have been a little bit crazy. My work picks up in the summer. I'm going to be moving shortly. My personal life has been a little wild. And so there's just a lot of things going on that have meant that this podcast has had to move a little bit to the back burner, at least in my, you know, physical doing things sense. Very much still top of mind, very much still trying to read and write poetry when and where I can. I don't know what to say beyond that. I mean, poetry is such a huge part of my life, and this is my favorite way of exploring it, is by sitting down with the people who write it and picking their brain. And so I do really look forward to returning to this, but folks, I just need a month off. I'm just going to take a month off. So I'll be back. It won't be long. And I am looking forward to returning, hopefully with some really fantastic guests, just like today's. Ooh, look at that segue. Here's Jen Curran, folks. I'm chatting with Jen Curran today, who lives in New Westminster, British Columbia, and teaches writing at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. Jen's first collection of stories, Hider Seeker, was awarded a Canadian Independent Book Award and was named a 2018 Globe and Mail Best Book. They have published four previous collections of poetry, The Sleep of Four Cities, Hagiography, The Inquisition Yours, which won the 2011 Audre Lorde Award, and School. Here I am chatting with Jen Curran. Okay, so this is our May episode of Page Fright. This is a literary Canadian podcast, and I'm thrilled to have a fantastic Canadian poet, a local poet, on with me today for this month. It's Jen Curran. Jen, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, Andrew. How are you doing?
Yeah, I think I'm okay. It's a nice sunny day in Vancouver. Things are coming up, and I'm reading poetry and talking about poetry. I mean, it doesn't get better than that, right?
Basically, so, utopia.
Yeah, no, totally. I'm so excited to talk about your book. It's called Trinity Street. It's out now with Anansi, and we're going to talk all about it. I've got some questions for you. But before we get into all of that, so that I could get people who might not have read your work yet acquainted with it, would you be willing to share a piece with us?
Sure. I'll start with the first poem in the book, which I think kind of sets it up. And it's called From Surrey to Commercial Drive. I was lucky. I caught the bus quickly. It lurched. I tripped. My neighbor and I shared an intimacy. Reading is dangerous. I'd better be ready. Body and argument, how we are garmented. Quickly caught the boss, told her two more books I'd soon finish. Two more. I had to stop reading. This poetry lucks me. Stole an apple from your house, but only to take it to my house to slice for your breakfast. A pigeon wing feathers my hair as I walk to the restaurant to meet a friend who says he wants to take fewer leaps in his poems, to stick a little longer with one thing. The leaping has become too easy. The bus driver is maybe new, maybe trying to tame the bus. It isn't working. This poetry winks me if my fingers hold the pen lightly.
I'm so glad you chose to read this poem. It is the first one in the book, but I still dog-eared it as one of my favorites. I was very excited that you started reading this one for us. Yeah, I really love this. There's some really cool thoughts about writing going on in here too that really stuck with me. One thing that I've been thinking a lot about in my own writing recently is leaps and leaping, and so the lines about that in here is very interesting. It's something that I notice you do a little bit in your work too, is that kind of leaping around and juggling almost like a couple things in one poem, which to me as a writer, I often get overwhelmed if I'm trying to talk about multiple things at once, or to kind of jump from one thing to another even can be a little bit scary sometimes. So for taking a leap like that in your writing, what kind of tips would you give to somebody who's maybe a little bit afraid of making those jumps in their writing?
That's a really good question. Yeah, so I think some writers are just more oriented toward a perhaps more collage aesthetic. And I would situate myself in that camp. I definitely operate as a collagist. I always carry a writing notebook. I'm always noticing things and taking notes. And then when I go to write, I lift things from the notebook as well as whatever happens to be around me. So it's a kind of a practice of constant attention and constant writing, if you will. And then when I actually go to, you know, work on a poem, I'm just working with what I've gathered as well as the moment, what's coming through in the moment. I would encourage folks if they really want to go that way, there's nothing wrong with writing a poem that sticks with one thing. That might be just someone's, you know, proclivity or personality or, you know, what they're doing. But if they're actually interested in working in a different vein, I would encourage them mostly to read, read poets who work in this vein. So one of my undergraduate teachers was John Ashbery. I was young. I didn't realize how big of a deal that was at the time. I knew it was a big deal, but you know, as the years have gone on, I've realized how incredible it was that, I got to work with him. And reading his work as a young poet around 21 years old just opened my mind to what poetry can do. And I started to understand more deeply this way of moving amongst worlds and moving through multiple worlds in a poem, being comfortable with big, quote-unquote, disjunctive shifts. So, you know, in Ashbery's poems, he'll have a he, and then suddenly that character's gone. There's a they, there's a she. Like, you know, you're just following, you're just with him, right? And of course, he was very influenced by the French symbolists, among others. And you know, you can see that kind of some of those slight surrealist tendencies in his work, surrealist and symbolist. But yeah, so reading, and there's so many great poets currently writing who work in that vein, right? Who use leaps or juxtapositions or the collage aesthetic to bring something to the page.
Yeah, and I love it too as a reader. I think I'm just kind of, I really like poems like this that are kind of jumping around a little bit, because I always find it so interesting how these things end up relating to each other. Whether or not that's the intention of the writer, the juxtaposition that you get is always really fascinating in this sort of thing. And I find, you know, it really depends on the poem, but often when you leap from one thing to another, you leave the last thing behind. But in a lot of your work, I felt like there was still a carrying forward of those things that we're leaping off of, so that these things are kind of juxtaposed against each other and in conversation with each other, which was really fascinating. But I really enjoyed reading that and noticing that in your writing as well. One of the... I wanted to ask too, because I've as I mentioned before we started recording, I've seen you read before in person. I mentioned Carly Bloom's book launch. Shout out to Carly if she's listening. But I really like your reading style, and I wanted to ask a little bit about this, because obviously as poets, sound has a big role to play in what we do. And often when you write something on a page, you lose a little bit of control over how it can be read. But when you're reading it yourself aloud, you have all of that control, and you really get to convey exactly how you want the sound of the poem to come through. And so all of this to say, I really enjoyed your reading style, and I'm wondering what you think makes a good reading of a poem.
Thanks for bringing that up. I don't get asked that much about performance and reading, and so I really appreciate the question. It's something I do think about. It's something I do think about, and especially I'm also a teacher. I teach creative writing at Kwantlen Polytechnic University, and so I work with young writers, and you know, so we'll do readings sometimes, and obviously we read in the classroom, and one of my colleagues recently actually taught a class on reading and performance, because we're like, we need, you know, the more practice, the better, even, you know, when you're a young writer kind of coming up. So for me, it's about presence. And so what I really try and do is just make sure I'm grounded enough to be able to be in body and give voice to the words. And that sounds very probably woo-woo, but it's, you know, practically speaking, that would be, you know, making sure I'm in a good state of mind. Like my mental health is pretty good that day. You know, don't be on social media too much. Don't, you know, do things that might make me feel more precarious or not great about myself. Practice at home a couple times just so I'm seeing how the words come out. And then when I go to the venue, I just try and really be very present and just be very in the moment with the words and the poem and the audience. You know, I mean, I've been so lucky over my career to read with so many wonderful writers, and that community is so important to me. So who you're reading with, you know, you're listening to their poems, really taking them in, then you share in the conversation with your own work. And then the audience, you know, I feel just a lot of tenderness for all the wonderful folks that come out to listen to poetry, right? And that kind of container that they hold. And so, you know, really taking it seriously that it's a rare opportunity to be with others and read poetry. And so show up for them and show up for the poems.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's the sort of thing that you come to appreciate as I'm still learning how to be a writer. I'm still very much in the early stages, but the rare chances I've had to read my poems to an audience have been really special. And I try to take them with gravity because they are kind of rare, it feels like. You know, you put so much time into writing a book or into writing a collection of any length or even just a poem, and it goes by so quickly that time that you're actually up there reading it. But it's fascinating, too. You mentioned community. I was talking to a friend the other day about ordering poems in a book, and maybe I'll ask you about that in your book, too. But one of the things I mentioned was it's kind of like, I've used this metaphor before, it's kind of like eating sushi, in that I think what you're supposed to do, although I could be wrong, is eat the ginger between the pieces of sushi to cleanse your palate. But a book, there's no ginger. So you're just eating piece after piece of sushi, and every poem is kind of leaving its aftertaste on the next one. And so when you're reading in a room full of other poets, it's the same concept, you know, there's a bunch of poets who read before you or after you, and your poetry is in conversation with those flavors, I guess, to extend the metaphor. But it's interesting too, how, you know, you might show up to a reading with something planned and then things change in the context of what comes before or after you, you know? I don't know if that makes any sense.
it totally makes sense. And yeah, well, I was thinking about it for two things that you just said, both the order of poems in a book and their relationship to each other, and that, you know, one poem will carry over to the next. That could be the quote unquote sushi aftertaste, or yeah. There may be one, or maybe that the next poem is the ginger, right? Before another, you know, roll or salmon roll or what have you. And yeah, when you go to a reading, I mean, that's the thing. It can sometimes be overwhelming. It's just too much for the system. Too many poets, or, you know, the tenor of the work might be very intense. And so it might be hard to stay present for too many readings. And yeah, was there a question in there, Andrew? I'm hoping I'm not going off on a tangent.
You're not. My effective question was, does that make sense? So I think you've answered that pretty effectively.
Yeah. So I like this conversation because I've been to many, many readings over the last decades and both as an audience member and a participant. And I'm thinking recently, I was hanging out with a friend in Toronto and she was talking about a class she recently took on the bardo with the Buddhist teacher Pema Chodron. And this idea of little bardos throughout life. So the idea of the sacred pause before the next thing. And I've really been carrying that with me, you know, this idea of the sacred pause. And so, in between readers, is there enough spaciousness for there to be a moment of sacred pause? You know, sometimes it's just, okay, a collective breath, and the MC gets up and introduces the next poet, and now we're with them, you know, and that's enough. And we're traversing that. Other times, you know, everything's too much, too fast, too furious these days. It's a real onslaught. And there just aren't enough pauses anywhere, and for me at least, for my nervous system. And I'm someone who actively seeks slowing down, right? I actively seek these spaces, and I am overwhelmed a lot of the time. So I'm kind of leaping off to another thing here, though. That is one thing I think poetry also can give us, is that space, that permission to pause. You know, I'm not going to turn on the TV. I'm not going to do this. I'm just going to sit here in the sun with this book of poems and my cup of coffee. And I'm going to be here with these words. And likewise, going to a reading, I'm not going to be on my phone. I'm just going to open my heart and let these words sink in to my mind and my spirit, my heart. So yeah, from sushi to the bardo is where we just went there, but
the perfect combination. I think I think it's true, like, and that's one of the things that draws me to poetry too, I think, instead of prose at times, is that, you know, prose, you're brought into this other world where things are going on, and it can be crazy, and that's not to say that a poem can't be crazy. Poems are, I mean, there's a lot of poets who are crazy, that being said, I think there's something meditative about poetry, and something that really does allow you that moment of pause that you're talking about. And that's something that definitely draws me to it. We were talking a little bit there about sound and reading. And so I think it's a good time to bring in for you my question from my last episode's guest. So,
Great, thank you. So
Jade Wallace was my last guest. Now, they did not know who I'd be speaking with, but they knew it would be a poet, and so this is their question for an unnamed poet, who is you. How does your poetic voice compare to your personal voice?
I would say, although friends and family tell me they can definitely see an overlap, I would say for me, in my conceptualizing of those two, well, they're not just two voices, they're like a whole choir. There's so many voices. but if I can separate it into kind of two binary categories, my written voice is, and myself, my own voice is, these are two pretty distinct things for me. So often poetry is talked about as nonfiction, and this is just never the way I've approached this, this genre. So even from my earliest writing, even in high school, I was already writing these weird fairy tale poems. They were so horrible. Thank God I burned them. But, you know, then I was writing, you know, stuff a bit more based on my life. And then, like I said, I studied with this Jonathan Aaron at Emerson. I went to study with John Ashbery. And I got away from this idea of poetry as nonfiction or poetry as realism. And so the voices that inhabit my poems or speak through my poems are, for me, quite different from my lived everyday voice. Although, again, friends and family will be like, oh, yeah, that's a very Jen Curran moment. Or, yep, I heard you in there, you know. but even my partner, when we first got together and I gave her one of my books, she was like reading it. And then she texted me or something and said, yeah, she said, it's this, this, and this with little glimmers of you coming through, is how she described it. And it's like, okay, so, and that's someone who, you know, knew me already pretty well then, and knows me a lot better now, obviously. But so I guess I think of it more that way. For me, poetry is fiction. There's so much freedom in entering the form and playing with it because it's my primary form that I've worked in for over 30 years now. I feel a lot of expansion, play, and the chance to take on personas, to be different selves. But there is, again, like in this most recent book, I think maybe there's more of a through line of voice. If the voice throughout this book might be stronger, actually, than some of my other books. I'm just guessing. I'll wait to hear what more people say as it gets reviewed by more folks or friends talk to me. But just noticing, you know, I another poet, Wayne Kostenbaum, had been nice enough to blurb one of my books a couple books ago. And he described it. He's like, I love Curran's voice, which is more of a murmur than a voice, which I loved. But my poetry editor was like, I don't know if we should put that on the back of the book. And it was like, well, yeah, because I guess it just doesn't sound strong enough, right? Like their voice, their strong voice, their inimitable voice. Oh, it's just a murmur, you know? But to me, that sounded kind of cool. Like, you know, I often struggle with, you know, like everyone, with ego and you know, having a self or selves.
Yeah.
And how much space to take up and what is a voice and who am I? And so I like the idea of a murmur. But yeah, maybe there's more, maybe this voice is a little louder in this book. I think it might be. I'll have to wait and hear from others.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. I love that idea of a murmur too. I think if somebody had said that about my work, I would definitely take it as a compliment for sure.
He meant it as a compliment. Yeah.
Yeah. And I agree that there's something really powerful about a poem where maybe the speaker's voice isn't authoritative or isn't the strongest part of the poem. And I like the idea. A murmur to me feels as if it's almost backgrounded or pushing something else to the foreground into focus, which to me can often be the role of a good poem. I mean, it depends on obviously what the subject matter is and the style of the poet, but I feel like there's something really powerful to having the speaker not take up space at times. I mean, you were saying struggling with ego and taking up space, and I mean, I do too, and it's something that I've been writing and thinking about a lot lately, but I think there's, you know, as much as I strive to tell myself, you can take up more space, you can do this and take up space, I think there's something powerful to leaving space in a poem too, is there not?
You know, will you say a little bit more about what you mean by leaving space in a poem in this context?
Yeah, I think what I mean, and the keyword is I think what I mean is that, like, you know, you talk about I talk about an authoritative voice and having a speaker say this is the way things are, and having a speaker show that this is the way things are. But oftentimes when the speaker becomes almost not the central part of the poem, I feel like that creates space for a reader to focus more on the imagery, the sound, the things that are going on in a piece. Whereas at times, and I'm guilty of this in my own writing for sure, I feel like you can have a speaker be a little too intrusive, or a speaker be a little bit too, I keep coming back to this word authoritative, although I don't know it's the best word, but a speaker who can take up a little bit too much space in a poem. So for me, I feel like I have that urge to say, well, you deserve to take up space, you should take up more space. And in most aspects of my life, that's probably true. But in a poem at times, I feel like I ask myself more, is it appropriate for me to take up this space as a speaker in this poem? And what does that leave as the focus of the text, you know?
It's such an interesting and rich question, and there's so many layers to it. I mean, I think we also read sometimes for voice, authoritative or no. It's that very inimitable, distinctive way of phrasing things or personality that comes through. I'm thinking, for example, of the poet Eileen Miles. And I love their work, and their work for me is so based on their voice, you know, and they're, you know, they're going through the everyday in their queer communities. And yeah, it's almost like they're having a conversation with you, this kind of conversational voice that animates their work. Yeah. So I guess the argument could also be made, it's all voice, even if we try to erase ourselves, you know, even if you're like, yes. I want to not exist, you know, I will not put myself in this poem. I will just use collage. I will just, you know, use other sources and you know, make collage this beautiful found poem. Still, we're the maker, you know, still we're in there. But I think it's also true that certain voices are just off-putting. Do you know what I mean? And you read a poem and you're like, wow, that's racist. You know, I know you're quite famous and what have you. I'm thinking of a Tony Hoagland poem that's, you know, I think been talked about a fair amount at this point, but, and it just immediately, a poet known for their voice is not the voice you want to hear. And so you turn away from it, right? Even if for others they're like, oh, but they're so compelling and the way they do this with language or what have you. So yeah, it's a big question, isn't it? Like, I wish I had something smarter to say, but I'm honestly still just thinking about, there's so many layers to this consideration. I'm thinking it through.
Yeah. And I mean, it's one of those questions that I don't think has a right answer. I don't think there's like a specific, because it's so contextual, right? Like when a voice is needed in a poem and when a voice is, you know, maybe less present and that foregrounds something really powerful. But there's no prescriptive like, oh, this is how it needs to be in every poem. And I think that would be a very narrow-minded way of looking at poetry. I think you have to be more open to things than that. But yeah, I just find it fascinating to think about the role of a speaker and the role of a writer as a speaker in a poem and how much of it, you know, needs to come from personal interpretation and needs to come from, you know, that voice saying the way things are and how much of it can come just from allowing that reader in. And maybe that's what I'm getting at is if, you know, the speaker is less present in the poem or at times even more present, the function of that is to pull the reader more into the text and allow them to enter that space that is left vacant or that is inviting and welcoming. I don't know. There's so much. Yeah, you're right. There's so much to think about here that maybe it's too much. Yeah.
No, it's good. It's a good sort of juicy complexity. And I think, and for some people, I just also want to underscore, you know, there's so many, obviously, there's so many different ways to write a poem. And there's so many different schools of poetry and different influences, different personal canons that people are coming from in terms of the people they've read who have influenced them. And for some folk, poetry is more nonfiction, and that's exactly how it should be. There's not a huge distinction between their voice out in the world and their poetry, and that's beautiful, right? That they're bringing that to the page and they're bringing that to performance. I really, you know, I have several friends that work in that vein, and I love their work and I love their performances. There's no one way, no right answer, as you were saying.
Totally. Totally. This might be a good point here to take a moment from our conversation and ask you if it would be possible to read another piece for us.
Yes, I will. Thank you. And this one, so Andrew and I, for the listeners, we're talking a little bit about just non-binary-ness before we started the recording. And so I'm just going to read this poem called Brackets. I had two sisters. Parentheses. I had a brother. I believed I had myself. After guitar lessons, laughter. After gender lessons, shame. Every shirt fit us both. I wanted to be both. The label said washed with light colors and cold water. The music teacher at recital said, "Where is your dress?" Flutes and clarinets broke in my hands. A reason to read was freedom, a way out of that moldy house. Whenever a board fell, I was responsible. Whenever a spider visited, bites festered. One by one, we drew an imaginary plant and climbed it into the clouds.
I'm very glad as well that you read this one. Another one that I dog-eared, perhaps unsurprisingly, given our conversation before we started recording. But one of the things I wanted to mention, and I have a question for you after this, but I do want to quickly mention, I have had a very fun time listening to you read these two poems that you have so far and looking at them in the book because, to be transparent, I've read your book twice. And the reason I've done that is not just because I'm a poetry nerd. Normally, I do read books a couple times, but I just came back from Europe last week, and it was like a very big, fancy trip that I don't normally do. But I was exhausted at the end, and on the plane home, I decided now's the time to crack open Jen's book. Now's the time to try and read this. And so I've got all these underlines and annotations and stuff that I'm revisiting now that I don't even really remember making because I was so tired. And so I'm glad I read it a second time to make sure that I knew what was going on. But yeah, your book was my companion when I was traveling. So that was fun. Okay. So the question I wanted to ask you, you mentioned, you know, in that last conversation we were having, how people can develop kind of a personal voice and a personal canon. And this has kind of been one of the main things we've been talking about. And so I want to ask you, you know, you mentioned you've been writing for a while. At this point, it may have changed, but Jen, what makes a Jen Curran poem?
That's probably maybe the hardest question you've posed to me so far. I'll see if I can answer it. I guess I hope that a Jen Curran poem is always changing and evolving, that a Jen Curran poem in Trinity Street is different from a Jen Curran poem in school or in the Inquisition Yours or my other books. I would say, yeah, as I referenced earlier, I continue to work in a collage aesthetic. That would be the biggest through line, in terms of form and process that I could point to, that I still, you know, my first poetry mentor when I was 18, Jonathan Aaron at Emerson College, said, start carrying a notebook. You know, you're a poet. You better have your notebook with you at all times. He encouraged us to have a tiny one we could fit in our jean back pocket. He's like, don't worry. You know, you always have it with you. This was before cell phones, of course. And so, you know, from that moment, many, many years ago, I've been always carrying a notebook. And so, yeah, I still work in that vein. I still draw from a notebook and work in a collage vein. I guess another through line when I'm trying to think of the years of writing in the books would be thematic. And so with the focus on queer relationships, in Trinity Street in particular, I'm centering friendship as the primary relationships, friendships as the primary ascendant relationships, the most important relationships we'll have in our lives. So a focus on friendship, on community in all the works, queer communities. I would definitely see throughout all of the books a focus on the environment and, you know, what we're now calling climate change, a concern about that, a writing toward a healing of Earth. And spiritual themes, I think, animate all the works. It's something that has always been of interest to me. And sometimes people think I'm a Buddhist. Even good friends will be like, they're a Buddhist. You know, I'm like, no, actually, but I love meditating and I love Buddhist teachings. But yeah, I'm very drawn to those worlds and those, you know, those ideas. So that also shows up in the work throughout.
Yeah, and definitely I haven't read a ton of your earlier work. So this was my sort of introduction to your writing, which was a very pleasant introduction. I really enjoyed reading this book. But I wanted to ask too, like, and you kind of gestured towards it there, but how do you think your poetry has changed with the amount of time you've been writing?
Yeah, it's each book is so different, and each book can, you know, it might take a few years. Usually it could take anywhere from 2 to 4 years for me to write a book of poetry. And this one was a long time coming. So there were actually, you know, some of these poems are as old as 2013, 2012, although a lot of those got cut. For me, I see the difference. Like there's a few poems in here. I'm like, oh yeah, you can tell that poem is much closer to school, my last book of poetry, which came out in 2014. Than it is to this poem that I actually wrote during the pandemic. You know, I can see a stylistic difference, even if thematically they're interlinked. So it's really hard to say. There's already been so many changes through each book. How this might be different, you know, my early work was quite dense, more like this, you know, with, as you can see, if you kind of flip through, there's not a lot of space between lines. There's these kind of chunky stanzas, although the lines are shorter. In my earlier work, that was also the case. I was working more on kind of chunky stanzas with slightly longer lines, often in the case. And then I started using a lot more space, so double spacing lines, giving a lot more space on the page. And there's a few of those that way in this book. Prose poems have always been a love of mine. So there's often a few in each book. I definitely want to write a book of prose poems someday. And my next book, which I'm, you know, hopefully working on a bit more this summer, and you know, I don't know when it will be out. I haven't even given it to my publisher yet, but will be a book of form poems. So because I've been slowly writing, I teach a forms class at Kwantlen, and I just love form. Like, you know, I love writing haiku and guzzles and palindromes and sestinas. And it's so fun doing it with my students. They've been my inspiration. And so that will be even a bigger leap, I think, working in those kind of set forms. And that book, I think, will probably be the biggest leap, maybe. I hope I answered that somewhat. It's very hard to speak to, honestly. It's hard to step outside. I am able to step outside myself and look at the work and be like, okay, the poem's doing that. But doing it in a more global sense, trying to track how my work has changed, is very difficult to do from the inside.
Totally. You brought me to something that I was hoping to ask you about there when you mentioned prose poems, because I admittedly have a fear of prose poems, both as a writer and a reader, I think, just because the reason I come to poetry, well, there's a bunch of reasons. One of them is that meditative aspect that we were talking about earlier, but another one is just logistically speaking, I mentioned this on the podcast before, having a short attention span. And so oftentimes when I see words condensed together in like this cloud of a prose poem, I get a little overwhelmed. But I persisted. I was like, I'm going to read these prose poems. I'm going to check these out. And I really enjoyed the prose poems in this book more so than many of them that I've read in other books recently. And I wanted to ask kind of like, how do you know, I guess, is what I'm about to ask. How do you know it's a prose poem as opposed to a poem with, you know, more standard line breaks or more crazy line breaks? How do you know that you've got a prose poem on your hands?
I don't usually. I mean, they just come out that way. They come out in sentences instead of lines. And times when I've tried to, you know, turn a prose poem into a line poem or vice versa, it very rarely works. Occasionally it's worked, but we're talking 1 out of 10 times. So they seem to arrive wanting to be in sentence form. And, you know, I love a lot of poets that work in prose. You know, I love Charles Simic, the American surrealist, was a big influence on me when I was young. And he has that beautiful book of prose poems, The World Doesn't End. If I'm remembering correctly, there was some kind of uproar when he was awarded the Pulitzer Prize, like, these aren't poems, you know, they're in paragraphs, you know. So, but I really like what the form can do, the disjunctive leaps that can happen between sentences. Again, that idea of the pause or the sacred pause, the period does that work, where usually we would look to the line break to do it. And there's this freedom, right? Because in a sentence, you can really range. You're like, ooh, I can pile this word on and do a dependent clause, and you know, how is this going to sound? I'm going to echo the end of this sentence with the start of the next sentence. So it's kind of interesting because you look at it and you're like, oh, it's a paragraph. I know what paragraphs do. You know, they're business letters and they're advertising and they're this. And then you get in there and you're like, oh my goodness, I'm lost. Like this is not the prose I thought I knew, right? Because it's a poem. And so there's this kind of trickiness that the prose poem plays with where, yeah, you've got those associations of the paragraph, but then all those literary devices that distinguish poetry, right? That density of imagery and that musicality. And they're hard to write. I mean, they don't always arrive. Honestly, I would love it if they came by more often, they stopped by more often, but I love reading them. But they definitely are their own beast, you know, and some people seem more drawn to them than others. Another influence of mine is great prose, and he only works in prose, American poet Russell Edson, who I read a lot when I was young, and it's all prose. These are the weirdest ass poems, so surrealistic, so strange, and I find that students often respond to them because what he can do with kind of plumbing the unconscious in this very bizarre way seems to speak to a lot of people. But yeah, so some people work only in that form. Others of us dabble. You know, and then, yeah, some people like yourself are like, I don't know, man, you know, am I going to write a prose poem? Yeah. So.
Maybe I need to try. I don't know.
Yeah,
do I need
why
to
not?
Try prose poem? Yeah. Maybe that'll be
called.
My Yeah, it could be my afternoon. Maybe I'll try and write something like that or see if it comes up over the next couple of weeks. Yeah, because I do feel a little intimidated by them, both as a reader and a writer. I think the Well, it is. I was going to say the lack of organization throws me off, but it's not a lack of organization because there is tons of organization. That's how sentences work. They're organized things for the most part. So there is a lot there that you can play with. I don't know what it is then that maybe intimidates me about them. I couldn't tell you. But yeah, anyway.
I think paragraphs can be intimidating, honestly. And I had a similar experience for many years with writing fiction. So I'm also a fiction writer, and I dabbled when I did my undergrad degree and my master's degree, and then never really continued. And I was always like, I can't do that. I love reading novels and stories, but I can't do that. I can't do that. There was this block for me. And it was only later where I was like, you know what? I love this form so much. The short story in particular, I just really love that form and what it can do, that I was like, I'm going to try and learn it. Even if I fail, I'm going to try, because I have such an admiration for what writers can do in this genre. And and it's interesting because, like poetry, it's like short stories, quote unquote, don't sell the same, you know, one of these genres that's a little bit more, you know, considered a step down from a novel in the weird capitalist hierarchy that now controls our literary world. But for exactly that reason, and many others, I find it such a compelling form to read and work in. So it's okay to be afraid. I think that's normal. And your intuition will tell you if you want to take it on. But you might, I don't know, if you like kind of surrealistic, weird, in the best sense of that word, work, you might enjoy Simic's The World Doesn't End. It's definitely in the library. So
yeah, I've noted the title. I think I'm going to check it out and give it a try, because that, and again, you say in the best sense of the word, and I repeat that, it the weirdness of poetry is something I'm trying to embrace a lot more. I think initially I started writing poems that I felt were very normal, focused on images, focused on sound, blah, blah, blah. And those things don't go away. But playing more with form is something that I've been meaning to do, and maybe a prose poem is the next step. I don't know.
This could be your gateway drug into the world of prose poetry. You might just become a prose poet after this. You never know.
That would be crazy. I'll keep you updated. I'll let you know if I come up with anything crazy.
Yeah. Feel free to send me a prose poem if you write one today or another day. I'd like to read it.
For sure. We're approaching the end of our interview, which is really too bad. I'm really enjoying chatting with you. But I'm hoping that
likewise.
I could get a question from you for my next episode's guest. Again, I don't know who they're going to be yet, but chances are that it's going to be the 80th episode. I'm going to call it now, probably another Canadian poet. So you can use that to contextualize your question.
Okay. I have a question. So my question to the next poet, and I really like this idea, Andrew, too. It kind of keeps folks in conversation with each other across episodes. So it's like a train car, a poet, like poets hopping train cars or something. Questions hopping train cars. So my question for the next poet is, what do you think your poetry or poetry in general most needs at this time?
Wow. That is a really good question. Jen, I don't know if you've listened to the show before, but I do this mean thing where I turn the question around now on you, and I'm going to ask you your own question.
I didn't know.
So, So what do you think your poetry, or in poetry in general, needs the most right now?
Gosh, that was kind of a cruel turn. You're really making me, giving me a taste of my own medicine. But it's good. It's very good medicine. I think my poetry needs to keep being brave and needs to keep being vulnerable, or get more vulnerable, maybe, and to keep expanding into things I haven't done before. So that those are some maybe goals for me, or things I would hope would happen as I continue to write, if I'm lucky enough to still be in body and writing in the next few years. What does poetry in general need at this time? I mean, I feel like, God, there's so much good poetry out there. It's like, maybe we don't need anything. Maybe it's happening, or it's, you know, just thinking of just some of the great poets I've seen read recently and all the books coming out that I'm excited to read. Let me think that through. See, I shouldn't have asked it of this poor other person. They're going to be in exactly the same boat, being like, this is way too big of a question. Why did they do that to me?
I think it's a good question, though.
I guess it's just kind of,
I don't know. I like what you said, too, about for your own poetry. The first thing you mentioned was to continue being brave. And I think when you hear the word need, what does this need right now? Mm-hmm. It's almost implying that something's currently missing. But in fact, what you might need is to continue what you're doing. You might need to continue down that same path. And I think what you've said about poetry in general, too, as you said, there's so many fantastic poets right now, so many great voices doing so many different things. Maybe we just need to keep going on that trajectory. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe what's needed is just more opening, more connection. I definitely think ongoing, you know, opening to each other's work and each other, you know, poets opening their hearts to other poets, building bridges across a difference, doing readings together with poets that might have even slightly different politics from you. You know, I think all that, and that's kind of capital P poetry or poetry community stuff, is quite important. Mm-hmm. And I guess just also back to the idea of the sacred pause, you know, do we need either more pauses in our poetry, perhaps? Maybe not on the page, but do we need more pauses in our life to even have the space for poetry? And I'm thinking of this, you know, very old essay at this point, but Mark Strand's short essay, Slow Down for Poetry, you know, which was so timely when he wrote it in, I think, 1990 or something. So I think it was in the New Yorker or something. And it's even more timely now. So maybe our poetry needs to breathe, to slow down. I'm not sure. It doesn't have to be any one thing. Some people are recording the onslaught, and that's also beautiful.
Yeah, no, I think there's so much to think through there that again, it might be another one of the questions, and maybe this is my fault as an interviewer, but it might be another question that doesn't have an answer, that there might not be one specific thing or too many answers to pick one.
Well, it could be, I would see that more as a virtue than a fault.
True.
But it depends on your tolerance for the discursive and maybe even somewhat chaotic. I feel pretty tolerant of those qualities in an interview. So
good. I'm glad. Then we're in the right place. We figured it out.
Yes.
fantastic. Okay, so we're at 45 minutes. Jen, if I could get you to read one more poem for us before we take off, would you be able to do that for us?
Yeah, thank you. So the poem I'm gonna read to close off our time together is the final poem in the book, and it's called Where is the Water in This Story? They weren't very good MCs talking about pistols, lavender, and last call. I had joined their cult to disappear, and instead, they gave me their gold-plated deity. She said, "We're not finished yet. No, no, these deities aren't done yet." Any choir might remember forgiving a song, and those mean men out back bearing another canister of cold silver. I kept thinking the lyrics would get better, that we'd all catch fire in our chests, shake out coins from pockets while changing clothes. But she was pissed. You can't trick a clairvoyant. Talking about you women, she meant the men, and those of us in between. She was serious, dishing up glasses of cayenne water to clear out the bugs crowding our intestines, each of her words a weightless orange. She suggested the disruption would be very interesting, or at the very least, possibly healing.
Amazing. I'm so glad you ended with that poem. It was another one that I really enjoyed. Jen Curran, the book is Trinity Street. You can get it now from Anansi. It's fantastic. And this interview has been so fun. Jen, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me.
Oh, thank you, Andrew. I thoroughly enjoyed it. And good luck with that prose poem if you write it.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll see how that goes. I'm going to give it a crack. We'll see. Okay, I'm going to stop recording and throw it back to me doing a little sign off. So there you have it. That was me chatting with Jen Curran, the author of Trinity Street, which is out now with House of Anansi. Jen, thank you so much for your time. It was really cool to sit down with Jen and talk about this book, because as I mentioned at the top, I'd read it a couple times, and it was really a big part of my last, I don't know, month or so. And so it was really nice to sit down with the author and to speak, you know, about this book and ask the questions that I had, and to get to know Jen a little bit better as well, because they are truly a fantastic writer and they've done so much work beyond this book that I've looked into since and have found out is pretty dang cool. So you should check out Jen's work beyond Trinity Street. But if you're looking for somewhere to start like I did, Trinity Street is a great place as well. Without much else to add, other than the fact that, you know, again, this is probably going to be the last episode for like a month. And a bit, you know, usually it's a month, but it'll be a month and a bit this time. But without much else to add beyond that, I'll sign off for now. I look forward to returning hopefully in July, and I look forward to speaking to you through this podcast again at some point in the near future. Folks, my name is Andrew French. I'm on Twitter at TheAndrewFrench, and this right here has been PageFright.